Any opportunity that presents itself where someone will pay you to learn something, definitely take that up, you know?
A developer from Cape Town in South Africa. And I came
Are
up with
you in
idea.
Cape Town right now?
Yes.
Wow, what a future we live in.
It's episode 14 of the WP Hackercast, and today I'm talking to Daniel Bachhuber. Daniel is an experienced WordPress developer, having worked for companies like Automattic and HumanMade. He is also a very prolific contributor to WordPress projects, such as the REST API and WP CLI, the command line interface for WordPress. Daniel and I had a great chat about a wide variety of topics, from his experiences leading the WP CLI project, his thoughts on how open source philosophies apply to the world around him, what he learned from Matt Mullenweg about the key to being successful in business, and the reasons you won't find him on Twitter. I hope you enjoy my chat with Daniel Bachhuber. Daniel, good morning. How are you doing today?
Yeah, quite fine. How are you doing?
I'm very well. Thank you very much. So today on the podcast, I have all the way from the States, I have Daniel Bachhuber. So just to get us started, Daniel, maybe if you can just give us a brief intro, who you are, what you do, and where you're talking to us from today.
Sure. So I'm a developer, full stack, kind of work across a lot of things. I'm an independent software engineer, so self-employed. Work with a variety of clients on a day-to-day basis. I also do sales for RTCamp, which is a WordPress.com VIP services partner. And I'm working today in my shed quarters, which is, there's a brand in the US called Tough Shed. They do prefab, you know, you design your own shed, but this is kind of like 2 meters by 2 meters. And then I finished the interior, you know, built it all out, that sort of thing. So it's my, you know, remote, global domination headquarters.
I like that. Global domination. I like that. So the fact that you're sitting in your office that's outside of your house, I'm going to assume that you have small children that you have to deal with.
I do, in fact. Ages 4 and 2. The 2-year-old was up at 4:45 this morning. Already he's pretty cranky, so... Yeah, it's good to have a physically isolated space. Although they will at times walk out of the house and come start tapping on the door while I'm on a call, and I just have to say, "Hey, Charlie, I'm busy right now. Come,
Daddy's busy taking over the world."
Yeah, right.
Interestingly, for the listeners of the podcast, you won't see this, but I can see that Daniel has a glass door. To my mind, I'm a father of 2 myself, also 6 and 2. Having a glass door, maybe not the best idea.
Well, it's good for natural light. So you'll see the interior of the shed quarters. There's a window right there. So I have some natural light. And then right above me, I guess the audio people aren't going to get this.
That's fine. We can explain. So what I'm looking at now, there's
Yeah, it's called transom windows. So it's a set of high windows. They're, you know, quite short, maybe 6 inches tall, 8 inches tall. And they let natural light in. But the big thing for me is that I didn't want glare in my workspace. I'm working throughout the day. And even with this window to the side of me, on a sunny day, it's too much light coming in. I have to put the shades down. Yeah.
So do you have any non-natural lights in the office?
I do. So to my left is a small little lamp, and then I have an overhead light that's, you know, hooked into electrical, system. But I typically don't keep this on because it makes the, when I'm doing a video call, it makes my face very dark and harder to see.
Interesting. Well, I must say from my perspective, the natural light seems pretty good there. So that's interesting. Okay, cool. So you've already discussed briefly in your intro, you chatted about your employment status. I'd like to dig into that a little bit because when you search Daniel online, quite a few websites come up. So maybe if you can give us all of the things that you're involved in and what a little bit of an intro of what they're about.
Sure. So I do, you know, I kind of have like a half dozen clients that I'm working with on a regular basis, you know, long term. So for instance, with DreamHost right now, I'm doing a lot of work in the kind of hosting community aspect of the WordPress community, building out open source tools and helping move the common conversation forward. I do sales for RTCamp. That's a ton of fun. That came about, I was at the VIP workshop last year, sat down next to the founder, Raul, and he was talking about, you know, he's always wanted to expand to the US, create a global company. And I've been to, or I had been to India a couple times before at that point. And I thought, oh, this sounds like a cool opportunity, you know? And I think one of the things that I really value about being self-employed is I can treat my entire 40-hour work week as, malleable, and, you know, allocate time as I want, and think of it as an entire portfolio of activities, and focus on doing work that's, you know, high value, high reward for me. So
interesting. So when you say sales for RT Camp, you mean physically selling product to people?
Yeah, we sell, you know, enterprise consulting services.
Okay.
And part of the motivation too is that I do like the sales process. You know, I enjoy selling. I enjoy that aspect of business. And of my own time, I can only sell so much, and I'm typically, you know, booked out. So this is an opportunity to continue getting to learn how to sell. And where I'm not selling my own time. And it's actually been very humbling too, because when you're selling your own services as a freelancer, independent, often people are coming to you on personal referral. They're already very pre-qualified. They know they want to work with you, that sort of thing. And in the agency world, it's just, you know, total humble pie, right? Because
yes,
it's a random inbound lead. You know, someone's found you amongst half a dozen others. And, the conversion rate is much lower, and, you know, it's a much harder, you know, sales process. So, I think one of the, you know, hacks that I've found to work quite well is, any opportunity that presents itself where someone will pay you to learn something, definitely take that up, you know?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think we may have already found our little quote for this podcast.
Yeah, right. So, you know, and in the relationship, you know, there's value that I bring to the table, certainly. And that's, you know, part of the motivation for RT Camp bringing me on. But then there's also lots of opportunity for me to learn and grow, and the whole team to learn and grow professionally. So, keep your eye out. Any one of those opportunities you come across, just take it.
Absolutely. That sounds amazing. Well, I'm hoping to go to my first international WordCamp, which is WordCamp Europe,
in
June. So I'll be definitely keeping my eyes open. So this is a bit of a non-technical question, but I always think it's interesting to dig into. So being a developer, are you a coffee drinker?
Oh, yeah, of course.
And what coffee?
I limit my consumption.
Okay.
We love these little Starbucks commemorative mugs. You know, go to a different location. This one says Hawaii on it. So every, you know, foreign location we go to, we look up the Starbucks, we buy a commemorative mug, and we've got a collection now of, you know, 20 of these. So this is 16 ounces, and I limit myself to 16 ounces of coffee a day, because otherwise I just go off the rails, you know.
So that's a one mug a day, and that's it.
Yeah.
Wow. Interesting.
Well, I'll do a mug in the morning, and then I'll do some like green tea in the afternoon.
Okay. Awesome. Okay. So I'd like to dig into your WordPress history now. So if you can give us an idea of when did you start using WordPress? Maybe if you can remember the release number or the date.
I can't remember the release number. But I do have the story. I know the story. So. My freshman year, I went to Whitman College. It's a liberal arts college in Walla Walla, Washington, southeast corner of Washington. And I got involved with a student newspaper. And at the time, a guy by the name of Andrew Witherspoon had initially set up the newspaper on a WordPress.com site. But then we ran into the whole, you know, limitations with templates, wanting to change the design, that sort of thing. So we thought, oh, we'll move it to WordPress.org and we'll create our own theme. And so we set about, you know, setting up a WordPress.org site, okay, relatively easy to do, creating our own theme, much, much harder to do. You know, I remember very distinctly trying to understand the concept of the loop and failing miserably, right? which is, it's an important concept to know just for templating. So that was really my entry point, was just, you know, I had something that I wanted to do and I learned any, you know, everything that I could to do it. And that's how I proceeded for a year or two until I ended up at the CUNY Graduate School of Journalism. Is that the next? Yeah, that was maybe, you know, 4 years later. And then at that point, I was responsible for managing a big old WordPress multi-site install for the school. Now, CUNY is the City University of New York. It's one of, I think, 33 campuses within New York City that, you know, is part of the city's education system.
Okay, interesting. And so just a quick question, freshman year, what year was that?
Oh, 2006.
2006. Okay. Okay. So you'll have to help me understand the terminology. Freshman is your first year of college.
Yes.
Okay.
Of a 4-year degree.
Of a 4-year degree. Okay. So you didn't come from, or at least let's put it this way. Did you have any interest in computers or programming before your freshman year?
You know, I did. And so for instance, in high school, I took a intro to computer programming class where we learned C++. But the kind of one quirk about my childhood is that my parents limited my screen time to an hour a day. So I could watch, you know, two TV shows if I wanted to, or when I was playing around with computers, well, I could only play around for an hour, right? And we had, and they also didn't, even though broadband was available, they were somewhat against the internet. And so we had dial up. So that kind of, it limited my own personal learning a bit, or exposure to, you know, I think some people have stories of spending, you know, 10 hours on a Saturday just poking around computer and figuring stuff out. And on a broader or on a higher level, you know, I think that's one of those advantages, disadvantages situation, in the sense that it's much easier to get into programming if you have a lot of free time to spend just picking things up and learning things. And so there's certain demographics, like socioeconomic demographics, where that's more likely, and they have that privilege, and many other demographics where they don't have the privilege to just monkey about on the computer all day. You know, they're having to work, you know, some job to pay for stuff. So, so it's kind of, I don't know, it's interesting, you know, observation nuance, in my opinion.
Absolutely. I definitely agree that that affects your ability to, as you say, learn and grow and play with. I mean, I'm 41 this year. And so when I was in high school, in you know, finishing high school in 95 in South Africa, the internet wasn't even a thing. Dial-up didn't even exist, you know. So
now, have a family computer at home?
So I had my own computer, and that was only because my uncle was quite sort of technologically knowledgeable, and he could see, he was actually a sales manager for quite a big plastics company based in Johannesburg. But he was also very interested in technology and gaming and that kind of thing. And he could see where things were going. So when I was 13, he managed to pick up a secondhand, I think it was an 086, I think it was, you know, a green and black screen that I played Tetris on. And I started fiddling with BASIC when I was in grade 10 or 11 or thereabouts, but that was it, you know. So there was no sort of family involvement. It was me just figuring out what I could. And it was only the year out of school I'd started working and, you know, the concept of dial-up became available. And it was, I think, a 14.4 modem and that kind of thing. So it was very sort of, you know, early days. I mean, the concept of being a web developer when I left school didn't even exist. So that was interesting. Awesome. So you started using WordPress at college. How did that knowledge, transfer to your first position, your first career, or did you go into something else before you became employed as a developer?
You know, I'm a really bad career person.
That's fine.
So what I wanted to be was a photojournalist. My freshman year, I applied to six unpaid or 6 unpaid photo internships. Didn't hear back from a single one. 1 paid web production internship, and I got it.
Okay.
And so that to me, my dad and my parents had said in high school years, and I remember this very distinctly, you know what, Daniel, you have very expensive hobbies. You better find a job that supports them. You know, like downhill skiing, that sort of thing. And I was like, oh, you mean you're not going to just support all of my expensive hobbies forever and always? Okay. You know, so I kind of had a little bit of that grounding going into college, but not a ton. Mm. And I come from a family, you know, medical family. My grandpa's orthopedic surgeon, dad's a dentist, that sort of thing. And so I'd ended up in school kind of on the pre-med track. But I just was not interested in medicine, right? So I did a little bit of pre-med my freshman year, but I'm a 3-time college dropout. And the rest of my college history is entering school, dropping out, entering school, dropping out, entering school, dropping out. And along with that, I started a hosting company for student newspapers. Oh, this is very relevant to my WordPress experience. Because about my sophomore year, I switched schools, and then I got really involved in the next student newspaper, and they were on a proprietary publishing system called College Publisher, and I wanted to move them off of it. So there's kind of many ways you can go about it. One is you build kind of capacity within that organization to make the switch, but you know, like student newspapers can be, they were resistant to the idea. So what I did is I started, this is just, you know, right at the time of Twitter coming about.
Okay.
I started reaching out nationally, trying to find other people that had already done this before and use that as a kind of like the vessel for capacity building within my own organization. And out of that, came out of the woodwork, you know, some people that had done it before, but also other students that were interested in the future of student journalism and publishing on the web. And we started this hosting company for student newspapers called CoPress. I did that for a bit, and that was part of the reason that I didn't really do well in school. The primary reason I didn't do well in school is that I wasn't good at school. I wasn't good, like, completing my assignments, writing essays, that sort of thing. I was like the classic student where everything was easy up until about, say, junior year. So I didn't ever have to study. I didn't ever have to work hard. And then I kind of managed to skate through junior and senior year, you know, by just faking it. But then, you know, college, it really hits you. College, you do have to study. You do have to write research papers, so on and so forth. And I just was not. It was not me, and I was not it. So I did CoPress for a bit, and that was ultimately unsuccessful, not profitable. And then that was all WordPress based, and it was an entry point into the rest of the work that I had been doing with WordPress.
Okay, interesting. So you mentioned that you applied for, I think it was a web-based internship, which you got. So tell us what that was like.
Copy and pasting out of Microsoft Word documents into
their
CMS at the time was called Bricolage, and they're now on WordPress, as a matter of fact. But at the time they were on Bricolage. The news organization is called Grist. It's an environmental news nonprofit in Seattle, Washington. And yeah, the extent of my job was copy and pasting out of Microsoft Word documents into Bricolage in formatting.
Interesting. I can only imagine that didn't last very long.
Well, it was an internship. I mean, you couldn't expect, you know, that's what interns are for.
Absolutely.
So it was a summer internship, 3 months. Yeah, I liked, you know, it was fun. I got to be an adult. You know, I got to live on my own. I got to commute into Seattle every day, you know, work in an office building, that sort of thing. It was quite fun. Awesome.
And then from there, where did things take you from there?
So to kind of quickly go over a lot of history. So I ended up at the CUNY Graduate School of Journalism, worked there for a year in New York. From that, I worked at WordPress.com VIP. It's an automatic kind of business unit for 2 years. Then I joined HumanMade, an enterprise WordPress agency based in the UK, but now global. And then I joined DFM, Digital First Media, which is a newspaper chain in the US. And I joined their Thunderdome, kind of like innovation R&D unit, that which was shut down 3.5 weeks after I joined. So I was laid off during my unofficial paternity leave with my first child. And at that point I was like, not so keen to go look for a full-time job again. And I started out, you know, doing the consulting thing. As a matter of fact, one of my first consulting clients I picked up did turn into a full-time job. It was with Fusion Media Group, which most recently is the entity that bought all the Gawker assets out of the kind of Hulk Hogan, you know, court case. So they're, you know, now what was Gawker is Fusion Media Group. And then, so I was director of engineering there for, you know, a year, year and a half. And then I have since just been, you know, fun employed.
I like that, fun employed. I'm going to start using that.
Well, it has a corollary, funder employed.
Oh,
I see. Freelancing calendar isn't fully booked out, then you're funder employed.
Interesting. So you mentioned that you made the switch from, well, you were forced to make the switch at least from being employed to deciding to be self-employed. And I think you said just after your first child was born. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So that must have been very stressful. Being self-employed, having a baby.
I don't know, maybe.
So far along, you can't remember.
I'm pretty easygoing and also very accustomed to volatility.
Okay.
In the sense that I don't take anything for granted these days.
Okay.
And I've got, you know, half dozen little experiments going on all the time, just because I know that, you know, 90% of them are going to fail. And I need to constantly be innovating with myself and what I'm doing in my career in order to remain relevant and top of my game. So that's kind of par de course, I think, for me, is the volatility aspect of it. What I have found is situations where there's a lot of stress associated with the work. Like I'm constantly stressed out about the project, you know, it's kind of hanging over my head. Or if I have, so for instance, the reason I left Fusion is because it became very corporate and it was just a lot hanging over my head all the time. That, you know, I've become attuned to what it's like to be in situations like that. And whenever I go down a path that results in that, then I'm just like, it's not worth it. You know, at the end of the day, like my priorities in life are getting good night's sleep, hanging out with my family, eating my wife's sourdough bread. You know, it's pretty simplistic. I'm not set out to advance my career in any significant way. Which is, it's a deliberate decision. Like I could care less about what title I have or, you know, what I've done on my resume or whatever, just because it's like, why, to what end?
Yeah.
You just, it's kind of a bit of a trap. Like don't go there. It's a trap, you know?
Absolutely. It's funny you say that, because I almost came to that realization a couple of years ago. So much so that whenever anybody asks me what my title is, I refer to myself as a janitor.
Yeah,
I'm usually cleaning up someone else's mess. You know, and that's kind of, because as you say, those titles, you know, when people call themselves CEO or managing director of a two-person company, you're just kind of going, you know, who are you trying to
Well, address? There's a bit of title inflation there. So for instance, with RT Camp, I'm director of sales, right? And some amount of that is optics as it relates to, you know, prospective clients and that sort of thing. But, you know, my motivations are just to live a good life and enjoy every moment of it. And having kids too. In having kids, I've really grown to appreciate my own mortality. Like I could die any day. They could die any day. Like shit can happen.
It's fine.
The language rating is on this podcast, but you know, there's lots of things that are outside of my control. And you know, I live with a healthy appreciation of that and know that, okay, the most that I can do is just enjoy every day of my life, do stuff that's fun, have positive impact on people and not get too bothered about everything else.
Very interesting. I want to ask you this, and this just kind of came into my head. Do you think that your involvement in, and let's broaden it a bit, let's not say WordPress, let's just say open source in general, mm-hmm. has helped you or has had any impact in that sort of way of thinking?
Yes. So two ways. One is prior to my first child being born, I used to get tremendously worked up about WordPress community issues in like, you know, there's this kind of concept on the internet. It's like where you want to be right. You know, I'm right. And like, I want to prove it to the world. Right. And right. So I used to get really bothered by that and keep me up at night and get all stressed out and da, 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 da. And then after I had my first child, it's like, oh, nothing else matters. You know, it's like having kids was very, very clarifying for that, giving me perspective on what's important and what's not. So that experience was a great learning experience for me, you know, kind of a lot of personal growth out of that. The other thing is I find being able to participate in this global open source community is hugely, hugely enriching and rewarding. You know, it's a very, very significant part of my career. You know, there's people that I've had relationships now with for a decade. You know, on and off, you know, we'll go a year without chatting, but then we get to reconnect and, you know, catch up and that sort of thing. And they're all over the world. Mm. It's like, in what other career do you get to have, you know, colleagues and acquaintances that are literally, I mean, I don't know a ton of people in like Russia and, you know, Central Asia and China. China is pretty accessible, but everywhere else in the world, Japan, India, Southeast Asia, not as much Africa, but certainly lots of Europe, now South America. It's like, what, you know, there are very few career paths in the world other than being a nerdy, you know, internet person where you get to have, you know, access to this global community, you know, it's very, very ready access, you know, access to different cultures, you know, learning opportunities, that sort of thing. So I find that tremendously valuable. And it's something that I want to bring to other parts of my life that are non, you know, technical web development. So for instance, I'm getting very involved locally, you know, civic, you know, governance, that sort of thing. And a lot of the values that I think the open source communities hold, I want to introduce into local government. So, you know, open, participatory, collaborative, that sort of thing. Because I think that, you know, a lot of people at the local level, you know, can benefit in the same way that I've benefited. And it gives you the, you know, even when you're working on, you know, problems specific to your community, to have access to the entire globe of knowledge and perspective and past experiences only accelerates your own ability to bring ideas to the market. You know, it's like, so if you're thinking about some local planning thing, like if you had ready access to like 1,000 similar experiments across the world, you know, that can greatly inform your own, you know, your own decision-making, the path you take, that sort of thing.
Mm.
You know, as web developers, we have that, right? It's like, if I'm working on a project, I just do a Google search, then I read some random GitHub issue where, you know, someone initially reported the same, you know, problem that I had 2 years ago. Then there's perspective from 15 different people as they've come across the issue over the last 2 years. And then I just read that. I'm like, boop, 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 boop. You know, okay, I got my solution.
Absolutely. That's amazing. Yeah, if I just think about that concept of being able to apply that methodology to solving local problems, that's really powerful.
Well, I think it could apply across all industry.
Yeah.
In, you know, all sectors. And obviously, you know, there's lots of cultural and pragmatic challenges to address along the way. but fundamentally the kind of open source being, you know, participatory, collaborating online more so than the license, I think can have broader impacts on the rest of the world.
Absolutely. I'm glad you mentioned that, you know, that open source, collaborative, participatory, regardless of the license, because that segues quite nicely into where I want to move into next. And I was literally watching your, I think it was WordCamp Europe 2016 talk about maintaining an open source project and the interesting downsides that can happen towards that.
Now,
for those who don't know, Daniel is the person, as far as I know, who originally developed WPCLI.
Incorrect.
Incorrect. So okay.
Started by a guy by the name of Andreas.
Okay.
And then for a good 3 years, another guy by the name of Christy, who goes by Scribview online, maintained it. That's how I got involved. So I started submitting pull requests to WPCLI while I worked for WordPress.com VIP. Just kind of scratching my own itch, but also VIP had very complementary problem set that I was solving through this, you know, kind of open source tool. And then Christy decided to step down because he no longer wanted to do WordPress stuff. And he said, "Hey, do you want to maintain it?" And I was like, "Sure, I don't know. I don't know anything about, you know, truly maintaining an open source project, but sure." And that's kind of how I ended up at the place that I was in.
Okay, thank you. Well, I didn't know that. But then, is this correct in saying that you started Run Command, which was the additional packages for WPCLI?
Yes.
Okay, great.
So failed attempt to monetize.
And that's fine. And I'd like to talk about, you were talking about earlier about always trying new things and seeing if things are going to work out. We'll talk about that in a sec. But as I understand it as well, right now you've stepped down as maintainer and Alon has taken over. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay, so I'd like to talk about that because my assumption is that at the same time as you did the talk, that was probably also around about the time you were thinking about stepping down. And it might have to do with either your work situation or your home situation or what we were just talking about. So I'd like to kind of dig into as somebody who has put open source code out there and blog posts, the how-to tutorials, and has interacted with some of that, right, you've put out free stuff, now people want you to fix other stuff for free. What was that like, taking over as maintainer and having to deal with what I like to refer to as the slightly negative side to maintaining a piece of open source software?
What was that like? That's a really open-ended question. What do I have to say on that? It was hard. I think it was challenging. It was an example of learning things the hard way again. So many times in my life, you know, I've just kind of done something just because, you know, my wife and I are very much, you know, do things, ask questions later type of people.
Okay.
It's just our personality, that sort of thing. And so for me, it was very much a case of doing things and, you know, kind of learning everything about it the hard way later. So one thing I would like to point you to is this lady by the name of Nadia Iqbal. Have you read any of her work?
I don't recognize the name, so I'm going to say no. It's possible that I have somewhere along the line.
I've dropped a link in chat and would highly recommend everyone that's listening to this to read all of her work. Because I think, so on a kind of a broader scale, I feel like my experience with WPCLI is representative of the broader open source world. In that, there's a spectrum of types of open source projects. There's very small, you know, hobby weekend, you know, hack projects, right? People have, you know, an itch to scratch and they build a project and that's fine. They publish it on GitHub. Then if a project gains any sort of popularity, it kind of grows to some awkward teenage middle years where it's gone beyond what's maintainable by one person as like nights and weekends, you know, kind of hobby time. And it's, you know, started to become dependent upon by lots of people. You know, people find free stuff on the internet and start using it. And then it hits this like really, you know, kind of challenging teenage years stage where it's just difficult to maintain. It's difficult to sustain. And there's lots and lots of projects and many examples of work just being abandoned because it's become too much of a maintenance burden. And then there's the large projects that have at least kind of one corporate backer, if not multiple, WordPress project being one of them, where it's the project really goes forward because it's in the corporation's best interest to invest in the project, maintain it, and move it forward. You know, React by Facebook is another one. And sustainability there is, it's like a different type of problem space than sustainability for the medium size, you know, dependent upon projects that are just, you know, it's like one person ran or one or two people randomly created it and it got popular on the internet. I'm not, that's like a tangential way of answering your question, but really I'd encourage you and, you know, all of your listeners to read up on Nadia's writings, because I think that they provide a very good, you know, portrait of, you know, open source, modern open source as infrastructure and how it fits into the broader internet today.
No, awesome. I definitely will. I will add that link to the show notes. And it's something that I'm also struggling with in my sort of personal. I don't experience it much with open source projects because there are no projects that I'm sort of maintaining for free. But in my blog writing, whenever I write blog posts where it's how to solve this problem, how to solve that problem, you'll have a percentage of people who come, great, thanks, that works. Then you'll have some people who say, oh, I couldn't get it right, and this is what I did, and you can fix it with, you know, you can show them where there's something missing or whatever. But then what I struggle with is the people who, okay, that's great, but now I want to do this. How do I do that? I'm not going to do that. Sorry. If you want me to do that, hire me.
So what I have found is you just have to develop a thick skin and know your boundaries and know when you say, yes, I'm willing to help, and no, I'm not willing to. You know, every so often I get an email that's like, oh, I have this problem. Can you help me solve it with WP CLI or whatever else? And I used to feel really bad replying and saying no. And now I just say, I'm sorry, I don't offer open source support by email.
Yeah. Yeah.
That, you know, yes. Just like, yeah. I'm not sure where you got this expectation that you could just email anyone on the internet and expect them to help you for free. But let me clarify, because that expectation is incorrect.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I forgot my other thought that I was going to say, but anywho.
That's fine. If it comes back to you, just stop me and we'll chat about it. Sure. So while we're on the topic of the WP CLI, I'd like to dig into very briefly, if you don't mind. I remember you set up Run Command as a premium sort of packages for WP CLI as a way, as you said, to monetize it. Then I remember there was a stage where you were asking people, what is WP CLI worth to you? What would you be willing to contribute? Right. And I'm proud to say that I chose my contribution amount and I made sure that I put it in. Mm-hmm. And then very soon after that, WP CLI actually became sort of an official WordPress.org project, if you will.
Right.
So was that something that, was that the way that you wanted it to go? Were you actively looking for it to become a sponsored, supported project? Or did it just happen and you were happy for it to go that route?
It happened. I had at the time wanted to keep it independent of the WordPress project for reasons that in hindsight have kind of proven unfounded. You know, it's fine being a part of the WordPress.org project. There's not necessarily any negatives about it. I think the best way to think that I think about open source these days as infrastructure. And so going back to the kind of city metaphor, well, the city and the county and municipality and what have you, well, they pay for infrastructure out of general operating funds, which are raised through taxes. You know, the city has the ability to tax. Whereas in open source, that there's no you know, it's MIT license. There's no ability to extract attacks on open on infrastructure maintenance. And I feel like that is one of the key challenges that we need to solve, because much of the internet is, you know, the internet is just cobbled together from a bunch of random open source projects that are, you know, at a varying degree of maintenance. And it's as though we've, you know, built all of this physical real world infrastructure just through a hodgepodge of, you know, means and ways. And then, you know, there's all these businesses that become, and, you know, economies and ecosystems that become dependent on it without any clear plan for how it's going, that infrastructure is going to be maintained for the long term. Fortunately, with software, it's much easier to just kind of like throw everything away and start from scratch. And I think that that's one way that people have managed maintenance burden over time, is that whatever point, you know, project just becomes, you know, so for instance, an example is PhantomJS. Are you familiar with PhantomJS?
I'm not.
So it's, you know, it's a tool library that you can use for what's called, you know, end-to-end testing. So it's a headless browser implementation. Okay. You write some tests and, you know, you run those tests in your test suite and make sure that the front-end application of your code is working as expected. Well, recently, you know, it's kind of one of these things where lots of people have been dependent on it and it's been in a very awkward state. And then recently, the Chrome team introduced a headless version of the Chrome web browser, and along with it, a library called Puppeteer that's a JavaScript implementation, you know, for interacting with Chrome. And with that, you know, it becomes a suitable replacement for PhantomJS.
Right.
And so, from my perspective, you know, using the real world metaphor, that's the case of, you know, everyone was dependent on some highway for shipping that was just like really run down. It's like, you know, imagine a highway that had a, you know, 6-lane bridge, and 4 of those 6 lanes were broken. Like the bridge had fallen apart and they were undrivable, and everyone was just driving the two, you know, on the 2 remaining lanes, you know, traffic backed up for miles. Right. And the bridge just wasn't getting fixed because there's no way to pay for it to get fixed. And so, you know, with digital infrastructure, eventually someone just comes along and says, here, we've built a new bridge over here, you can use this instead, you know.
Everybody's going to use that bridge.
Yeah, and so people start switching over and using that bridge, and then the old bridge is just kind of left in place to eventually, you know, completely fall apart and die. So, you know, to kind of put a real world, you know, metaphor to it, better understand the problem space. So I think of, you know, kind of the way that the history of the internet's played out is that anytime one of these projects, you know, kind of truly dies, well, then someone will just fork it or, you know, create from scratch, but essentially create a comparable substitute. And, you know, and then there's this tension too between, well, to apply a license that forces users to pay some tax on usage, well, how is this different than, you know, proprietary license? You know, and I think in that, you know, it's particularly in the GPL world, right? It's like we are like fully in the religion of, you know, you cannot ever charge for software, right? Well, although people do premium plugins, that sort of thing. I think that, you know, the part of the challenge too is this separation between software that is infrastructure versus software that's kind of commercial nature. So infrastructure, you know, going back to the real world metaphor, infrastructure is like, you know, in a city, it's the street, it's the sidewalk, it's the lamps, it's the sewer, it's electrical, that sort of thing. It's all, you know, key necessary, you know, parts to enabling commerce on top of it. And then you've got the burger, you know, joint on the corner that's a commercial enterprise, and they can charge for burgers. You know, no one expects to get a burger for free. So infrastructure is what enables commerce and community and public participation on top of it. So I think, you know, where does that boundary exist in the software world is much more nebulous, because you could argue, well, you know, this form plugin that I've built is infrastructure, so I should be able to charge a tax on it. Well, it's, you know, are you a commercial entity? You know, maybe it's actually a commercial product that you're selling, and so therefore, you know, you sell it through the, you know, support and updates model.
Mm.
So a huge tangent. I forget what even we were.
That's fine. About. No, that's actually it's very interesting.
I can't wear
because
my mind at that. Yeah,
it's very interesting because, you know, I think I actually recorded a podcast with the WP Builds podcast. It's two chaps out of the UK, specifically about the GPL and all that kind of thing. And I think that, you know, open source software almost forces people to change how they think and how they do things. But what's interesting about it, you know, specifically what's interesting about the GPL is there's nothing in the GPL that says you can't charge for that piece of software. There's nothing that prohibits you from doing it, but because it's released as this free piece of software and it supports the four freedoms and that kind of thing, the users of the software, in my opinion at least, have this opinion, and I feel sometimes it's not right, at least, that they should always be able to get it for free. But it's interesting that you kind of, you know, you take it as this, you know, infrastructure versus commercial, you know, where does something fall in? And I think that, at least in my opinion, when it comes to open source software, it's difficult to apply the real world example to the open source environment because of how different it is with, you know, what you can do. You know, if I buy a burger, then I can go and give it to somebody else, and that sort of makes sense. But if I am driving down a street, I can't take that street and give it to someone else.
Right.
You know, so it's interesting to kind of look at it from that perspective.
Yeah, and I think another important aspect to understand about the GPL and open source generally is that open source is a business model, in the sense that the open source, the business model of the open source world, well, of the WordPress world at least, is to, so you kind of like throw away the software, you get give away the software, and your goal is to get to 100% you know, penetration, so that there's you have like capture of the market through monopoly software penetration, not through, you know, you've sold the software. So then, you know, for instance, Automattic has a business model that's predicated on, you know, massive adoption of the WordPress software, and then, you know, they charge for services on top of that and closely coupled to that. So there, you know, the kind of feeling that open source is all like bunnies and roses and, you know, nice, or at least the GPL is bunnies and roses and, you know, nice shiny stuff, I think is a bit of it's a bit of a cheap way of understanding it, because in reality there are economic motivations, you know, business motivations for the GPL license is biased toward certain types of businesses. It provides an advantage to certain types of business models, for better or for worse. It is what it is, you know, but the GPL is not this pure or holy, you know, incarnation of how software should be created. It's just, you know, software with a different bias.
Just one way of doing it. Absolutely. Yeah, no, that's very, very true. So I'd like to swing us back now to sort of WordPress focus questions, if you don't mind.
We're not talking about WordPress right now?
Well, we kind of are, but we kind of weren't, and that's quite nice. I like the fact that we actually went off into more of a broader scope. So these questions are very opinionated questions. They're very subjective, so don't feel like there is no right or wrong answer. It's whatever your answer is, and that's one of the reasons why I'm doing these interviews. In your opinion, what is the biggest positive thing about using WordPress for any project?
The backend user interface, I think, is world-class. I think that's the primary motivating factor for both enterprise and consumer use of WordPress, and its, you know, strongest asset. And so for that, I'm very optimistic in long Gutenberg, because for all of its shortcomings, I do think that Gutenberg stands amongst Dropbox Paper, which I consider to be the next or the best in class kind of like editor experience, and does represent the kind of foundation for a WordPress for the next 10 years. So obviously there's lots of challenges in the execution that still need to be addressed, and success is not guaranteed. But for me, Gutenberg aligns very closely with what is the core value proposition of WordPress, and, you know, builds upon its current successes.
Awesome. You kind of answered my next question, but that's great. So while we're talking about Gutenberg, for those who don't know, Daniel also released recently the Gutenberg plugin compatibility project, where you can help test plugins and check whether they are compatible with Gutenberg or not. Would you like to maybe give us a little bit of history as to how this project came about?
Sure. So that came about last November, and it ties to WP CLI, because so my relationship with WP CLI was, you know, long, happy, and healthy, and after a certain point, you want to move on and do new and interesting things. And like, boy, do I love contributing to WP CLI as a contributor and not having to maintain it, because now it's just fun again. You know, it's like when I submit a pull request for something, you know, it's just I just submit a pull request and Lang, you know, merges it and whatever. So. So I was kind of looking for a new challenge to work on, and, you know, looking around, thinking, and it's like, oh, Gutenberg, like, this is going to be a big old mess. And, what I saw, the opportunity I saw is that if you could, you know, a lot of the challenge in rolling Gutenberg out is, risk mitigation. In this sense of, so Drupal, for instance, you know, Dries announced a couple weeks ago that majority of Drupal sites are still on Drupal 7, because they, you know, a significant, you know, break between Drupal 7 and Drupal 8, and organizations haven't found the justification to upgrade to Drupal 8. And it's like, oh, that's a big old problem. You know, so it's like, and when we roll Gutenberg out, if the majority of WordPress sites stay on 4.9 and don't go up to 5.0, and that's a big problem, right? Hmm. So there are breaking changes in Gutenberg. You know, that's just part of the nature of what we want to do, and you know, what we need to do. And how do we, you know, is there anything we can do prior to releasing WordPress 5.0 to know whether or not the rollout's going to go well or not? That's kind of the problem space, and risk mitigation as a concept, you know, trying to like de-risk the rollout as much as possible and achieve the outcome that we want. And so then I had this thought, it's like, you know, it's like, well, major source of whether or not Gutenberg works for an end user is going to be plugin compatibility. You know, if any one of their plugins are incompatible with Gutenberg, then Gutenberg is a breaking change for them and an undesired change, right? So if we can quantify plugin compatibility with Gutenberg, then we have much more data with which to make our, or at least guide our decisions around whether or not Gutenberg is ready, whether or not we've done all that we can to, you know, mitigate incompatibility, that sort of thing. So it's, you know, it's a crowdsourced database where there's a setup where you click, you know, launch new test environment, takes you to a sandbox environment created by WP Sandbox folks there. And with the plugin that you're testing in Gutenberg active, and then you can report, you know, yes, the plugin works as expected, or no, this plugin is not compatible with Gutenberg. And then once we have that data in aggregate, then we can do statistical analysis around, you know, some percentage of WordPress installs we expect are compatible with Gutenberg at this point. And we want to do what we can to move that from whatever it is now to whatever it's going to be in the future. The challenge, though, with that database right now is that it requires a lot of person hours to generate the data, and we haven't figured out what we need to figure out in order to do that.
Okay. Interesting. Well, yeah, I would highly recommend if anybody is wanting to get involved. I'm also a tester on this, and I try and include a a few plug-in tests with my sort of morning coffee. It's really easy. It's really quick. As Daniel said, you load up the sandbox site. The plugin is installed. He's recorded a couple of videos for what you can test and what you can look for. I'm looking at the site now, and I think you launched it officially about 2 months ago. Is that right?
Yeah, it was beginning of March.
So since the beginning of March, there are 82.82% plugins that haven't been tested yet. So just short of 20% have been tested. So that's about 10% a month. So we've got another 10 months at least if we want to get this thing going.
So what I'm eyeballing at this point is there's this Try Gutenberg. Have you heard about this? The idea is to include a dashboard.
I heard it somewhere, yeah.
Yeah, so include a dashboard widget in 4.9.6 that's a call out that says, hey, install Gutenberg and try it out, that sort of thing. And the idea is to, so that's going to get a lot of user feedback. And if we can kind of flow that user feedback in a way that we can pull out plugin incompatibility information from it, then conceivably we can just have someone monitoring support threads and then popping that data into the incompatibility database. The other thing that I'm considering is right now I've built this database on top of NAC, which is kind of a, you know, build your own web app SaaS thing. And the reason I did that was purely out of, you know, as a developer, it's very easy mentally to build your own solutions for everything, but that's also the more costly way of doing it because, you know, costly in terms of time and that sort of thing. And so with this NAC, I was able to build it in like a couple hours instead of spinning up a WordPress install. But I think it's also proved to have some limitations that might be blockers and that maybe we would be better off, you know, building this bespoke in a, you know, into WordPress.org or something like that. So
okay. Interesting.
TBD.
Cool. Absolutely. Then my next sort of long question before we get onto the short questions to sort of wrap things up is, in your opinion, what is the biggest negative thing or what is the biggest reason why somebody might not want to consider using WordPress?
It's a dumpster fire.
I like that answer. Why is it a dumpster?
Why is it a dumpster fire? Well, as a matter of fact, so I was testing some of my really old plugins the other day for Gutenberg compatibility. You know, plugins I haven't updated in 6-7 years. And they all worked. Like, they all worked with WordPress, which totally blew my mind that a plugin that was released in, you know, I've stopped working on 6 years ago, I can activate and it works just fine. You know, even like where I had written jQuery and JavaScript and whatever, like that still worked even too. So I think that that is one of the truly amazing things about WordPress is its commitment to backwards compatibility and the fact that, you know, like I don't know of any other, even like an iOS app or Mac apps, you know, you can't install a 5-year-old Mac app and have it work. You know, or there's very few, you know, but that's kind of, it's still a given the WordPress ecosystem. And I think it's one of its greatest assets. And along with that comes with the fact that, well, you've just got to carry all this technical burden and baggage with you, you know, for better or for worse. The most important thing I think to understand about operating in the WordPress ecosystem is that WordPress's software is biased towards the end user, not the developer. You know, like Honey Badger don't give a shit about you, WordPress developer. You know, you're just like, you know, the 10 developers before you and the 10 developers after you. And so, you know, I think part of a healthy relationship with WordPress is understanding that it's software to you know, achieve, you know, it's a means to an end and it's designed for the end user and it's not designed for you, the WordPress developer, although you're occasionally accommodated for in the process. So don't get all hot and bothered about, you know, WordPress being a, you know, technical debt and dumpster fire. Cause you know, frankly, it's not about you. It's about the end user.
Absolutely.
You know, if there's justifiable reasons from an end user perspective to manage technical debt, then yes, certainly. But managing, you know, refactoring just for the sake of refactoring is not ever a good idea, you know, in WordPress, but also in the broader world.
That's absolutely, I couldn't agree with you more. That's absolutely
so true. I have a blog post that I wrote that I now have to find. I'll drop it in the chat too.
Cool. That'll be great.
So it's the title is Humanist Software Development. And this is kind of something that resonated with me in the last year, you know, kind of ideas that I had that I wanted to capture. But really three principles to live by when you're writing software, that, you know, humans come first. You take pragmatism over purism and simplicity over complexity. So what I mean by humans come first is that software exists to serve humans and we don't exist to serve software. So when you're creating software, it's always for some end user need in the real world. Second is pragmatism over purism. I think sometimes you get caught up in arguments about what's the technically most correct implementation, which is just like an endless rabbit hole that you will never escape from once you go down it. And instead focus on, okay, what is it that you're trying to achieve with the software? And is a good enough solution sufficient for the real world, you know, use case it's being used in? And then same thing with simplicity over complexity. Humans, I don't know why, but we have a tendency to create more and more complex systems. You know, I think that we're naturally predisposed to prefer complexity over simplicity, but complexity is more expensive to maintain over time and cause, you know, greater likelihood to break, more difficult for other entry points and that sort of thing. And so the harder work is figuring out what simplicity is in a system and focusing in on that. You know, think about software. Well, you know, hardware. Are you an Android or iOS user?
Android.
Okay. I think even Android very much has some of these tenets in the sense that, you know, you as a human, you enjoy software and hardware combinations that are simple and work intuitively, solve the problem that you want them to solve. And anytime you come across someone's designed software and it's got 100 options, you know, 100 little toggle on and off switches, you're just like, oh my God. But you have to realize that at some point, you know, there was a human on the other end that designed that software that wasn't really thinking about what they were doing and ended up in this state where there's 100 toggle options to control the most mundane stuff that doesn't even matter. Like the software should just work. It shouldn't have a bunch of configuration that you have to do, figure out, that sort of thing. So it's the underlying tension in being a software developer is that really you need to focus most on your end user and not what you as a software developer think is most correct.
No, that's so true. You're so right. And I'll definitely share those links.
I forgot what the question was too.
No, that's fine. There wasn't a question, but that's fine, really. this is what this podcast is about, is gathering this kind of knowledge. So really, don't feel...
Philosophical leanings.
That's fine. I love it. So I'd like to wrap this up now, not because I don't enjoy chatting to you, because I do, but I'd like to keep the podcast to roughly an hour.
Yeah. Sure.
So we're gonna round it up with a couple of short form questions. These can be as long as or as short as you want them to be. So if it's just a one word answer, that's fine. If it's a little bit longer, that's fine too. So I'm gonna start off with, if you could change one single aspect, if you had full sponsorship to spend, let's say, a week to change one aspect of WordPress today, what would you choose and why?
I think the greatest opportunity, I really love automated build testing. Mm-hmm. And I think the greatest opportunity is in some system for capturing visual regressions and user interface regressions that have, you know, highly visual components. And I don't know if it's buildable in a week, but I think that would be a very valuable problem to solve.
Awesome. Then besides the default, let's say WordPress or web languages of PHP, JavaScript, HTML, CSS, What other languages are you either familiar, comfortable with, or use sort of on a more or less monthly basis, let's say?
English.
Okay, fair enough. Then when you're coding, what editor are you using and why?
I use Sublime Text.
Okay.
And I use Sublime Text because on a Mac, there's, you know, there's like, was it Carbon and Cocoa are the two underlying application frameworks? Mm-hmm. And they provide, I think it's Cocoa that provides like the most native experience. And then there's stuff like Atom by GitHub that is, you know, it's HTML, CSS, JavaScript instead of Electron. And I really don't like that janky experience. I like native applications. Okay. I'm very sensitive to all of those kind of perceptible, you know, user experience details. And Sublime, I used, what was the one before Sublime? Oh, TextMate? Yeah, TextMate.
Okay.
So I came over from TextMate into Sublime, and I use my Cobalt 2 theme that I've used, used TextMate. I tried Vim. I used Vim for like 4 weeks, but I found that my productivity was hampered and that it was going to be, you know, greater than 4 weeks to kind of get up to the same level of productivity. And also I didn't find any compelling reasons to use Vim other than, you know, kind of cross machine portability in the sense that, you know, same editor experience on a server is not on the server. But I only do server stuff like 5% of the time. And so I can just use Vim when I'm on a server and I need to do that stuff in Sublime otherwise.
Fair enough. Then what development environment are you using? Vagrant or Docker or
Valet.
Something like that? Valet. Okay. Interesting.
It's good. And
it's good. I had the same response from Alain. So
I like Valet over a virtualized system running on my machine because, you know, I like bare hardware in the sense that just much, much faster to run software in on directly on top of hardware than in some virtualized system.
Okay, great. Then in terms of your, and I want to focus more on your sort of day-to-day development tasks, what tools do you, let's say, what are the top three other tools that you use to help either with things like productivity or keeping track of time or keeping track of projects or things like that?
Oh, sure. Love it. So I use Git Harvest. Well, okay. It's called Harvest, but the domain is getharvest.com. Mm-hmm. I'll just drop a link for time tracking. And it's like my favorite software in the whole world. Mm-hmm. And I think that time tracking is very, very valuable. And I'm tracking time right now. And if you aren't tracking time right now, then you should be. Because time is your most valuable asset as a human. And if you don't know where your time is being spent, then you don't know how you're moving forward in life. So you should have a sense of which are the most valuable activities to spend your time on and focus on doing those and not doing the other stuff that you don't need to do. So Harvest is one. I use iTerm 2 as my terminal in the full screen mode. So I just, you know, toggle in and out of full screen. And then the last bit that's kind of key to my personal workflow is called Things.
Okay.
It's a Mac application to-do list. And I haven't updated to their new version 3, in part because I'm slightly terrified by it. They changed all the UI and I'm like, why did you do this? It works just fine. Like, and I don't know that it's going to work any better. In fact, I'm afraid of it being of working worse. So I'm on Things 2 right now, but I may consider Things 3 now that I am looking at it again.
Awesome.
So those are kind of like the key basics to, you know, productivity and workflow. But I think it's really, you know, tracking time, tracking tasks. Like anytime you have, you know, thought on your head, oh, I need to do this, put it down on your task management tool or your list or whatever so it's out of your mind. Keep your mind free for being creative, exploring bigger problems, that sort of thing. And then time tracking, you know, helps you make sure that you're spending time on what's most valuable.
Absolutely. Then second last question, are there any sort of new, besides you spoke about the sales thing earlier, are there any skills or languages or techniques or anything that you're learning at the moment?
So I'm learning a lot about housing policy and urbanism. And I'm also, I'm keen to start some side company sort of thing. Now they've had the failed experiences of trying to sell a variety of different products. So in addition to Run Command, I'd also started a website as a service platform called Toothpress for dentists that failed. And then I also created a plugin called Bylines that saw mediocre success, and I ended up selling it to the folks at Publish Press. And I've got some failed experiences under my belt, and I'm ready to start another businessy thing. So that's very much on my radar. And I love the kind of bootstrapper ethos and movement. So the two resources that I like the most are Indie Hackers. And Indie Hackers is a forum and a podcast all focusing on bootstrapping. And then there's a podcast called Startups for the Rest of Us that I quite like as well. And in fact, on the subject of just recommending good content, there's a TV series in the US called The Prophet that is this, well, it started in 2013. And at the time, I'm not sure if he still is, this guy by the name of Marcus Lemonnier or something. He's the CEO of Camping World, which is a chain retailer in the US. And it's a reality TV show. And he comes into kind of failing or struggling small businesses and helps to reform their business. And so his whole shtick is people, process, and product. Like that, those are the ingredients to a successful business. And if your business isn't successful, then one of those aspects is lacking. So I watched the full season like last week, full first season, and I really like it because he's very, I love learning about business in the real world because it's, again, a refreshing dose of humble pie in the sense that, you know, we've got it quite easy in the web world. You know, if you come upon a successful, you know, business, product, whatever, with something software based, it scales really nicely and the margins are very good.
Mm.
And in the real world, like that is not, it's not the case. Like, so one of the episodes for The Prophet was he's helping a family owned ice creamery kind of expand and grow. I think they were doing $2.5 million in revenue and he wanted to help them get to 10. And it's like they had to buy a effing factory and invest $1 million into building it out. And, you know, it's like, wow, the real world is not difficult. Like I can just build a widget and sell it on the internet and make bang, boom, done. You know, so it's like, I think it's great perspective to have if you're interested in entrepreneurship at all.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's interesting. I'll definitely check that out. Then the last question, I always ask this to everybody, and it's always interesting to hear what people say. If you could go back to, let's say, the day that you were thinking about where you were going to study, that when you were going to go and, you know, study the first time, your first college or whatever, if you could go back in time to Daniel then and give him one piece of advice as Daniel now, what would that piece of advice be?
I think it'd just be keep going. You know, just do it. I think I wouldn't change anything. I think every experience along the way has had some learning components to it too. And very much, you know, advice to anyone would be treat everything as a learning experience. Don't get so caught up on, you know, it being immediately successful. One of the things I've really appreciated from Automatic and Matt as, you know, kind of business operation is you look at WordPress Automatic.com, Automatic as a company, that sort of thing. And, it, you know, it's an old company now. And there's been lots of points along the way where there's been some existential threat. Like, for instance, Tumblr. And what is Tumblr now, right? And it's like, from that, I've kind of like learned that survival as a business strategy is undervalued, in the sense that if you just outlast your competitors, then you win.
Right.
You know, just like let them like fight themselves to death, and then you just outlast and you win. And I think that people really, you know, it's, there's a ton of truth in this saying that people overvalue what they can accomplish in the short term and undervalue what they can accomplish in the long term. Mm. And a lot of that is just persistence. So, you know, if I'd say anything to my younger self, it's just like, you know what, just, you know, keep going, do it, you know.
Just keep swimming.
Persist, yeah. Just keep swimming. Yeah.
Awesome. I think that's a great way to end this off. Daniel, thank you very much for your time. I think that I know that you're not a very active person on social media. As far as I know.
Oh, I deleted my Twitter account.
Yes, you deleted your Twitter account. And
F that, man.
You're welcome. You're welcome to send me. I know there was a link that you posted about why you did that. I don't want to get into that now, but you're welcome to send me that link, and I'll add that to the show notes as well. But if people want to catch up with you online, want to follow you on maybe a blog, where can they find you?
DanielBachhuber.com/feed. That's my RSS feed.
Cool.
And my email contact is on there too.
Awesome.
Yeah, I love not being on Twitter. Like, oh my gosh, it is.
So, I'm seriously getting close.
just you know, take the leap. It's amazing. Yeah. You have so much free time. Mm. Again, going to like quantifying how you spend your time. Prior to quitting Twitter, you don't really know how much time you spend thinking about, you know, your how other people perceive you in your relationship within this, like, you know, everyone's looking at one another type of network. And then you realize, you know, I don't need that, you know, I don't need to be a part of that for my day to day. And it just frees up all this mental energy to do stuff that's more interesting.
Absolutely.
Don't get me wrong. Like, I loved Twitter at a certain point. It certainly benefited me, you know, many points along my journey. I think the challenge is that it started out as just like a fun, friendly conversation. And now it's so wrapped up in optics and, you know, people marketing themselves, marketing ideas, but so focused on marketing and not on substance that it's more rewarding now to, you know, have conversations like this, but even, you know, have more in-depth conversations with people that have, you know, experience that you want to learn from.
Absolutely. That's so very true. Well, again, thank you very much for your time. Hey, I've really enjoyed chatting to you. I look forward to seeing where you go to next. I look forward to hopefully one day meeting you, and thank you very much for your time.
Hey, thanks so much.
Cool. Cheers.
Have a good one.